Hi, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. And today we're not going to be coming to you from our studio as we normally do. Instead, we've taken our show on the road, as they say. We're in this unbelievable palatial estate. This building is about 200 years old. It's an old imperial building. It's right in the heart of Moscow. And now it's being used as the embassy of Iran. So we have come here, and they have been gracious enough to invite us to have conversations with them. And I'm going to have a conversation with His Excellency, the ambassador of Iran, because there's so much to talk about. Obviously, we're going to have conversations about Mr. Trump and Mr. Putin and Mr. Xi, and conversations, passionate conversations, about what's going on right now inside of Iran. And the relationship between Iran and the rest of the world. And then, of course, the most important question of all is the 12-day war, as we've come to call it. Is it over? How did it end? And what will Iran's relationship with Israel be like moving forward? These are the questions. And this is the conversation that I'm about to bring you with the ambassador of Iran, Qasem Jalali. Mr. Ambassador, thank you so much for inviting us. Thank you for being here. I so look forward to this conversation. Let me start with this question. The 12-day war, as the President of the United States calls it, between Iran and Israel, why did it end? Why did it end?
In the name of Allah, the Almighty, thank you. Dear Rick Sanchez, it's a very nice opportunity to be talking to you. We've been cooperating with Russia today for a long time. As you know very well, that the logic upon which the Israeli regime has been acting is the logic of violence. We realize that where they can, they will use violence, and so they are using violence to pursue their own scenarios by way of force. Where they can't use their brute force, they look for opportunities for ceasefire, for a truce, for a temporary truce, because the foundation of this Israeli regime is not a foundation of peace. If you look at events that took place 13 years ago, they attacked Lebanon, different regions of Lebanon, especially the conflicts and the hostilities in Gaza. Back then, Israel agreed to a truce exactly when they couldn't attack anymore. As for the Islamic Republic of Iran, of course, Israel had planned a big operation against us. At midnight on Friday, they killed some of our commanders. In terrorist attacks, they exterminated our nuclear scientists and they killed lots of civilians attacking peaceful residences. What they were thinking about, you asked why the war ended, they thought that a regime change would take place. They believed they'd be able to change the regime in the country and bring into power very different people. We saw that Israel and the US failed at a regime change. We'll talk about that, why they failed. One of the reasons is the will of the Iranian people, and the other reason is in our history. They saw that we promptly and quickly managed to assign new commanders. And I can say that within 17 hours after the beginning of the aggression against Iran, in 17 hours, we started our own retaliation strikes against Israel.
I have to ask this question because there's a lot of people who are wondering, were you tricked? Did you really feel that the negotiations were still going on? And did you feel like you had Mr. Trump's word that he would hold off Israel from any attacks until you had a chance to settle your argument regarding nuclear enrichment and other concerns. Were you tricked?
ببینید ما در حالی
Yes, look, they started the operation, the military operation against us at a time when we had agreed that we will have negotiations in Muscat. In fact, we were in the middle of negotiations. There was an atmosphere of negotiations. Of course, we were prepared, I mean, from a military standpoint, we were not exactly relaxed. We were always ready for defense. But for over 30 years, the Israeli regime had been threatening to attack our country. For over three decades, Israel has been accusing us of trying to make a nuclear bomb. And of course, there was a threat. But at that time, we thought we were in the middle of negotiations. We and the Americans were in negotiations. And we thought that after the negotiations, we realized that what the next scenario would be. Yes, indeed, it was a big plan to deceive us.
So, can you ever trust the United States, this administration, again, after they were, as you described, deceitful with you?
Yes, this is a very precise question. And I think it's not a question, it's not only a question to us, but to any person, basically, who would take a look into this situation. Anyone can understand why Israel is still in negotiations, despite Trump making peaceful gestures, indicating that he's ready for negotiations. We understand, every person understands and asks, therefore, on what logic are we going to have negotiations from now on? It's now a matter of mistrust. We didn't trust the Americans before, in fact. We have always said that there's a big wall of distrust between Iran and the US. And the top of that wall is getting higher and higher every day, because they've been pursuing a wrong logic, a wrong policy. To have an example, to give you an example, we had nuclear agreements before. There was a nuclear agreement, an agreement between us on matters of nuclear technology, between Iran and the five other countries, including the United States. Every party had its certain obligations and rights, and no party could waver those obligations. And now we are witnesses to a situation when Trump, when he came to power, he immediately withdrew from nuclear agreements. He pulled out of them, he ignored them. This is a violation of obligations. This is a breach of obligations. At that time, our president said that we cannot work with this administration, with this president, because they do not observe their obligations. The same example here. By conducting the military operation, they start a military operation basically in the middle of negotiations with us. The second part is about demands laid forth by the United States. They are excessive, they're not legal, they're not logical, and they're not in line with international legislation. This is essentially racketeering. On the basis of international law, we are member to many nuclear treaties, the non-proliferation treaty. The only thing we cannot do under this treaty is to create a nuclear bomb. Otherwise, we can use all the rights to develop nuclear technology. And President Trump says that we cannot enrich uranium. We say, where is it said in international legislation that we cannot enrich uranium? Where?
So let's be clear about this. This is really important, and I think the whole world wants to know what Iran's position is on this. What you're saying to me is, look, we need nuclear power to create energy.
to have electricity for the people of Iran. And that's all that we have been doing, and we're not trying to convert that into anything else. And we have worked, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I hear you and others say, you have been working honestly with the Atomic Energy Agency to make sure that that is in fact what is happening. Is that true? Did I get that correct?
Yes, exactly. This is exactly so. Let me explain further. Considering Iran's nuclear program, the biggest part of IAEA inspections were carried out in Iran. Over 75% of IAEA inspections budget is on Iran. It's the statistics. On the other hand, our defense doctrine does not provide for the creation of a nuclear bomb. We are confident that a nuclear bomb does not guarantee security. Even nuclear powers can continue, well, conflicting. Otherwise, we have a fatwa and the order of our supreme spiritual leader, which is above the law, that we should not move towards creating a nuclear bomb. On the other hand, Israel, for at least 25 years, Israel has been saying that Iran is just about to get nuclear weapons. Doesn't anyone wonder that for 25 years, Israel has been lying? They've been saying that in 3 months, Iran will get a nuclear bomb. Then 3 months passes, we still don't have a nuclear bomb. So it's all been a lie on their part. On the other hand, I confirm that we are not moving towards making a nuclear bomb. Our supreme leader once said that we do not want to make a nuclear bomb. Iran does not have a will to create a nuclear bomb and is not moving in that direction. And everything they've been saying, Israel, I mean, is one big lie, and IAEA inspectors have been to any nuclear object in Iran, and we've been in negotiations with many countries on that.
You have decided now that you are not going to cooperate with the inspectors because, when last I checked, you feel like they were dishonest, they were conspiring with Israel, and they were maybe not being honest. I guess I come back to the same question I asked you before when you said you were tricked by Mr. Trump. Do you feel now you were cooperating with the inspectors, you were trying to be honest about what was happening, that's Iran's position, and after doing that, Israel still bombed you, the inspectors, according to some reports, were collaborating with Israel, and you don't feel that they were doing an honest job. So, once again, I have to ask you the same question. Because of that, do you now feel like, okay, you know what? We used to be cooperating, now we're not gonna cooperate. Now we're no longer going to do what we were doing before because you have treated us this way. Is that your position?
Let me tell you, our parliament passed a decree, Iranian parliament, after the bombings of Iran's nuclear venues, nuclear facilities, the parliament passed a law that says that until IAEA guarantees the security of Iran's nuclear facilities and guarantees that no intelligence data is passed on to other parties, other countries, until that Iran suspends its cooperation. It doesn't spend it, we're still members of the NPT, Non-Proliferation Treaty, we still work within the international legislation and we will continue doing so. So we're not considering ourselves above the international law, but we say that Israel is violating international law. The USA is breaking the international law. They have bombed our nuclear facilities. Thus, they are in breach of international legislation. We have a council inside Iran that's called the Supreme National Security Council, and the president is the chairman of that council. And within that council, a decision was made in what formats Iran will continue to work with the IAEA. When the IAEA guarantees, gives us the guarantees we need, then within this Supreme National Security Council, they hold sessions once a week, and there they decide how and when we will open a way for cooperation with the IAEA. We have not entirely closed the way to cooperation with the IAEA. We still work within the international legislation. We observe it and we think it's fundamental. But the United States and Israel have violated this international law. The first legislation is the fact that Israel has a nuclear bomb. They are not a party. Israel is not party to the non-proliferation treaty. Do we get it right that any country from now on that is not part of this treaty can have its own nuclear bomb? Another thing is that any country's nuclear facilities on the base of the NPT should remain untouchable. Nobody has the right to attack other countries' nuclear facilities. And what's most interesting, the NPT member country, like Iran, they attacked Iran nuclear facilities. And at the same time, they were supposed to observe international law. And Israel, not a member of this treaty, they also attacked us, our nuclear scientists, our nuclear facilities. And we are very saddened to see that the international community also supported them in that. The first organization to condemn them was supposed to be the IAEA. Why haven't they condemned Israel? If we take the situation with the Zaporozhye nuclear power plant in the Ukraine, when there were firefights and hostilities between Russia and Ukraine in that area, IAEA would issue resolutions every day condemning the hostilities. That's double standards at its finest. Totally different approaches. And this is what we have been observing in this process. But still, I emphasize that on the base of international legislation, we continue to cooperate with international organizations, considering our interests and our rights.
Let me ask you this question, which I think there's been a lot of reporting throughout the West, that the real reason Mr. Trump stopped the war was because he wanted to save Bibi Netanyahu's political rear end. And the damage that your missiles were doing in Tel Aviv was substantial, according to a lot of reporting that has been coming out of the West again, right? What do you make of that? First of all, do you think that's the real reason that Mr. Trump asked, or maybe Bibi Netanyahu asked Mr. Trump to stop the war? And two, if it's true that your missiles had a substantial impact on Tel Aviv, does that embolden you as a country in terms of what kind of deterrent you could create in the future?
The question of why the war ended, we said first that we will not be the first to start a war. And the moment they stop hostilities, we will stop them as well. It wasn't us who started the war. It wasn't us who started an aggression against any other country. I'll tell you more. Do you know that our formula is that there has to be a democratic process in place? We never thought of destroying Israel by military means. It's a lie that the Israelis have been advocating. We're not even neighbors. We had a whole different position. Our position was that Israel essentially, Israel will essentially work its own country into collapse because they don't want to live in peace with their neighbors. They're egotistical. It's an egotistical state. Israel wants to dominate the region, to prevail in the region and everywhere. Our propositions, the propositions of our leader, were entirely different. We even registered it in the United Nations. Our position was that any human living in the territory that is called Palestine, that is controlled by Jewish communities, there has to be a referendum, and within that referendum, let people decide their own state. And who can take part in this referendum? Any Jew living in this territory, any Muslim who lives in this territory, and any Christian on that territory. Basically, any human. Even an atheist living on this territory, let them all take part in this referendum and decide their future. This was the proposition coming from the Islamic Republic of Iran, and I think this is the most democratic way of achieving peace on the territory. As for Israel, let me tell you this.
We know that this regime never wants peace. Peace will never be possible. They don't want peace with any country. The Oslo I and Oslo II treaties, as well as some other treaties signed between Israel and Palestine. And did Israel observe the terms of those treaties? And we also have the Abraham Accords. They don't even recognize Palestine's territory. And they're trying to trick the Palestinians. We don't see any stability resulting from those treaties that they call peace treaties. If we want a ceasefire, that should mean that every human living in this territory has to take part in the decision-making process. And as for the war, you asked about the war. Before they felt our strikes, they didn't want a ceasefire. That's important. Let me emphasize that. Before they were hurt by our missiles, they didn't want a ceasefire. For 12 days, Trump's and Netanyahu's statements and positions were very strong. Netanyahu was very strong in his statements on the first day of the aggression. Netanyahu called for Iranian people to go out on the streets. That's what Netanyahu said. And when Trump was asked by journalists about whether it is time to move towards a ceasefire, Trump said that no, it's not the time yet. But 5 or 6 days into the operation, the Islamic Republic of Iran and its missiles determined the progress of the war. We hit centers of Mossad and their tech centers, and the Israelis asked America for help to achieve a ceasefire.
Just quickly on that, a follow-up. Were you surprised? It seems like many people around the world thought Israel's Iron Dome is not penetrable. It is so amazing. There's nothing that will ever get in. Any Iranian missile will be shot down, in fact. That was not the case. We all see the evidence with our own eyes. Were you surprised by the effectiveness of your missiles in Tel Aviv?
Well, I'm not a military expert. I'm not a military man. And I didn't have precise information regarding our military capabilities. I'm a diplomat, but indeed I'm very proud of the capabilities that my country showed. We understand that Israelis had fought with the Arab countries before, and they had conducted large-scale operations against Arabic countries, pushing them far away with Egypt, with Syria, with Jordan, other countries, Jordania. And the Arabic countries even once fought together against Israel, but Israel had won before, and they all touted their Iron Dome system, claiming it's bulletproof, that no missile could get through. We understand that Israel is a proxy army for the United States. Basically, it's the United States supplying armaments, supplying air defense systems. We know very well that Israel is basically a product of the US military. You understand that they have a tiny territory. And look, the Russian Federation has 17 million square kilometers of territory to control, and Iran has 1,600,000 kilometers. I was surprised when our missiles struck objects in Israel with pinpoint accuracy. And let me tell you that our military told me that we hadn't used even part of our military power yet.
You say that Iran means no harm to America, and I have yet to find any evidence where Iran has attacked America, or I have yet to see any plans for any kind of terrorist action against America on the part of Iran. It's hard to not substantiate what you say. But I'm an American. How should I take when I hear the chants, death to America? How should I receive that? Should I be insulted? Should I think something bad is coming? Is it a threat of an attack? How, as an American, or as Americans, should we understand that chant? Help me understand it.
I can answer your question. There are two things here. How did this chant come around during the 1979 revolution? What happened back then? It wasn't a chant that we were taught to say. It happened in the middle of the revolution. Due to our very bad experience with the United States, especially the behavior of the United States in Iran before the revolution, you know that Dr. Mossadegh's government that we had before, he wanted Iran's oil rights to be taken away from the British. He wanted to claim Iran's oil from the Great Britain. He was our prime minister back then, and he asked for help, the United States to help. He asked America to help them become independent. And the Americans deceived Mossadegh, our prime minister. They fooled him. He worked in New York in the United States. He wanted to work with the United States against the British. And the Americans had a separate treaty, an agreement with the British. They created a concession. They got a cut in it. And they staged a coup against Mossadegh. So basically, a person asking the Americans for help, they staged a coup against him. And there are over 20 such cases. The Americans have been doing those atrocities for decades. And when the revolution...
Ukraine?
We wanted to say that we are against crimes. We are against violence. We are against a state that does things like that. Those chants were addressed against, as a reaction against what had been done against the Iranian nation. Another thing, the people of Iran, the government of Iran, do they have any differences? Do they have any beef with the Americans? No, we don't. We consider, we view the Americans as any other nation on earth. We are not against any other state. We are not against any other religion. We are not against any other people. We say that we should live in peace on the base of international norms and regulations. So on the part of the Iranian state, Iranian people, there are no differences with the American people. We have differences with the American political system. Look, as the President of the United States You basically say that the Iranian people have no other way out other than capitulate. That's humiliating for Iranians. I, as an Iranian, when I read Trump's tweets that I have to surrender, what do I have to do? Of course, there will be hatred against the American policy. We do not wish death to anyone. We don't want terrorists to be there. We are against terrorism. We are against violence.
I actually think that there is a possibility that what just happened in Iran will perhaps actually unify the Iranian people in ways they maybe weren't unified before. Some of the reporting I've seen and some of the sources in Iran that I have spoken to have told me that there's a lot of young people in Iran who don't like the direction of the government, who think it's a little too strident, maybe even too religious, and they want to go in a different direction, and you know, all the women don't want to cover their heads, and et cetera, et cetera. But now, because of what just happened in the United States, they're kind of going a little more in the other direction and becoming a little more pro-government because they feel like they were done an injustice. Is that true, or am I just kind of thinking that maybe in ways that aren't actually happening? What's your take of what's happening with the people inside of Iran?
Yes, you're absolutely right in your view of the event. I can confirm that. I'm far away from Iran just like you. I basically see the events in my country from afar, and I can say that Iran is back to the atmosphere of 1979 after the revolution. We Iranians have always tried, we still do, to turn threats into opportunities. And we think that there will always be threats. We can never say there are no threats at all, but we can turn threats into opportunities. And we think that God Almighty, well, helps us in that. Over the last 45 years after the revolution, of course, there have been certain differences between the people and the government. And a certain part of our people are, of course, not satisfied and pleased with the actions of the government. And of course, there have been conflicts about that. But Israel, through their aggression, they indeed forced our people to unite. They have united us. We have some oppositioners who live abroad, and indeed they have been displeased with the Iranian government. And even those people, well, those people once left Iran because they didn't agree with Iran's policy, and now they support Iran.
I'm thinking to myself, is it possible that that microcosm that is Iran, on a micro level, the same thing is happening on a macro level? Because Israel right now is so hated around the world, and especially in the Arab world, and especially because what people see with their own eyes in Gaza, when they see 17,000 dead children. I mean, how do I not see that and not be angry, right? Just as a human being, not as an Israeli, a Jew, a Muslim, an American, a Catholic, just looking at it. You just look at it and you go, that can't be. That has to be fixed. So if what you just said is happening in Iran, Israel is making people in Iran come together, is the same thing happening, you think, globally, and especially in the Arab world? Your country, for example, you've had hot and cold relationship with the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, for example, for different reasons. Do you think because of what Israel's doing now, the chances that you will become closer to Turkey and Saudi Arabia and other Qatar and other countries, Jordan, and other countries in the Middle East, for example, will improve? Do you see that coming? Is that something that's on the horizon based on Israel's actions as well? So I'm saying micro, yes, macro too?
Man, با تحلیل شما کاملا موافقم.
Yes, Yes, I absolutely share your view. I agree. There have been several important developments recently. Number one, as you noted, Israel, with its aggressive policy, with the atrocities it has perpetrated in Gaza, basically forced the whole world to unite, basically forced any peace-loving human, basically made every peace-loving human mad at what is going on. We're living on the peak of technological civilization, and at the same time we're watching people burned alive, we're watching scorched earth. We see people lining up for water and killing each other for water. There's no food, there's no medicine, there's lots of casualties. Many people left under the rubble, and they... So, we live in this world where we say we're civilized people, and at the same time we see these barbaric developments going on. It's there for the whole world to see, and the whole world is really getting angry at this, at Israel's atrocities. When Israel performed this act of aggression against us, hatred towards Israel grew higher. We have seen the United even actions of protests held in the USA in support of Iran. And some European countries also had support actions. This is what really happened. And governments in those countries really saw that they can't continue supporting Israel this openly. They now have to support Israel in disguise. They understand that their nations really don't have any more patience left. As for our region, the Gulf countries, they saw that Israel has only one goal of aggression. Israel is bent on aggression. It's been attacking those Muslim countries. We have no doubts that if Israel moves on, if Israel feels more confident, it will continue attacking other states as well. Because the essence of the Israeli regime is aggression and crimes. They say from Niles to Euphrates. One river is in Egypt, the other river is in Iraq, and they are contemplating a territory from Niles to Euphrates. We understand that they think about attacking other countries. Now we have great relationships with neighboring countries, with adjacent states. We are thankful to Arab countries and countries around Iran, in Istanbul. There have been very strong resolutions in defense of Iran, and we are developing.
I'm thinking, so will the anger and hatred for what Israel's doing in Gaza and has perhaps done in Iran supersede the dissension or the conflict that has arisen for many, 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 many years between the Shias and the Sunnis in the region? How's that for a question?
I can say two things again here. In principle, well, Mr. Sanchez, I'm not saying we don't have any differences, but they are really insignificant. I should say it's the Anglo-Saxon movement, the Anglo-Saxon habit of exaggerating those, of stimulating those. In the 19th and 20th centuries, they've been, well, basically fanning this fire. We have a lot, the Shia and Sunni have a lot in common. We have a single confession, and Muslims know that very well. But you have pointed out a very important thing. We don't have significant differences, and those that there are, they have been created artificially by the Anglo-Saxons. On the other hand, when Iran supports the Palestinians' right for self-determination, We do not defend Shia. We defend the Palestinians. And Palestinians are not Shia, they are Sunni. So we are defending basically the Sunni people, and we want to continue supporting them. If there were Christians there, we would be supporting Christians as well. Another thing, in Iraq and Syria, when we were fighting against terrorism in Iraq, especially in the areas where we fought ISIS, and those were Sunni regions, and our soldiers died in those very regions. And ISIS couldn't even enter those Shia regions. And our generals Soleimani and our military advisors who helped combat terrorism there, they fought against terrorism in Sunni regions. What's most interesting, when General Soleimani liberated the regions of Iraq, there were Christians there and even atheists, but we still liberated them, we still fought for them. And our soldiers were dying there, because our criterion is defending humanity, is defending humankind, defending right and justice. Our position is standing against oppressors. We don't want to use military power to enhance or extend Shia. It's not our position. There are over 20 million Muslim citizens in Russia, and most of them are Sunni, but they are all our brothers. We pray today, we pray together, we sit down with them, we make rights with them, the same rights. But you are right in saying that Israel has made a great mistake. They indeed united Sunni and the Shia.
Let's talk about Russia. It appears, by all measures, that Iran and Russia have, right now, an amicable relationship. You could say, historically, Iran and Russia have had amicable relationships. So recently, Mr. Trump, who now is having seemingly weekly conversations with Mr. Putin, which is good, but weird compared to the past, where American presidents wouldn't even talk to Mr. Putin. But apparently they're talking. That's good. And they've had conversations, apparently, about Iran, where Mr. Trump wants Mr. Putin to help him with Iran somehow, because he thinks that he has a lot of sway, maybe, with Iran. There's even a report that came out, by the way, that I should add. There's a report that was in Axios where they said that Mr. Putin urged Iran to zero enrichment of uranium. Moscow said that's fake news, it's not true, they would not tell you what to do, it's not their job to tell you what to do. So if you want to react to that, that's great, but more importantly, has there been a relationship where Mr. Putin has spoken to your president or your supreme leader regarding perhaps messages from Mr. Trump?
Yes, indeed. Vladimir Putin, on the first day when Israel started the military operation, he had a phone conversation with the president of Iran. And that was the only phone conversation on the first day of war. We know about a certain part of the negotiations and the conversations between Russia and America, and we hear reports in the mass media, but our relationship with the Russian Federation is very good. And what Axios wrote, and basically Russian Minister of Foreign Affairs rejected that as a dirty campaign, as a fake. I think they're trying, in a time like this, they're trying to drive a wedge between allies, basically. We understand that Iran, Russia, China, and other allied states work together. Israel is driving, is trying to weaken this front. So with these fake news, you understand that the Americans and the Israelis mostly work through mass media. You are an expert in mass media. You know how this works. You know that it's a very powerful tool. The media is a very powerful tool. And basically, Israel, well, holds prevalence in mass media across the world. So they're using the media across the world to drive wedges among allies. But we have great relationships with the Russian Federation. Our leaders are always in contact. They're always talking and consulting. And during the 12-day war, our Minister of Foreign Affairs flew to Moscow for negotiations. We are in close contact, and ministers of foreign affairs of Russia and Iran met just last week in Rio de Janeiro. And this week, they met in Tianjin in China at the SCO foreign ministers meeting. So, of course, they are in regular contact.
So let's talk about the situation finally with Israel and where this can go. I'd like to think that it's over. Israel attacked you, you attacked Israel, and now we can all walk away, and hopefully for my children and my grandchildren and your grandchildren, the world will be a safer place and this will not conflagrate once again. I'd like to believe that, but it would be like believing in Santa Claus. I want to believe it, but it may not be true. I fear that this thing is not over, that somehow we have not gotten to the end. Tell me what you think.
Yes, I think you're right. I also think you're right. The essence of Israel, the very nature of Israel, is violence, aggression, and crimes. And I'm very sad to say that the NATO and the United States supports Israel in that. Israel is essentially a representative of NATO in the US and the Middle East, an envoy, an outpost. So Israel keeps thinking how to extend its dominance in the region. And what saddens me most is the fact that no international organization, no regional organization has responded except making empty statements or resolutions. They hold protocol meetings, they make photos, but they don't say anything. What message is there? Why is the UN there? Well, the UN was established to prevent wars, to prevent aggressions. After the war, they agreed to create the League of Nations, but that organization failed to prevent the Second World War. The Second World War took place. Then they established the United Nations to prevent any further wars. So I'm asking you, as a journalist, Israel attacks Lebanon, Gaza, Syria, and eventually they end up attacking us, Iran. What have the international organizations done? What is happening in Gaza is barbaric. So my question is, in this world, are there any rules except brute power, except brute force? And this only forces us all to become stronger and stronger, to accumulate power and military strength. You realize that this is an armed peace. This is the period of militarism. It's always being ready for war. Lots of armaments being sent to the Middle East. Piles of weapons, armaments piling up. Well, it would be good for your viewers to see the pictures. To see pictures of children slaughtered, killed in Israeli attacks. Look, they're children. They say they were targeting the military, but where do so many slaughtered children come from? Four of those children were killed in the hands of their mothers. There were several women who were pregnant. They were pregnant and they were killed. This girl's name is Baran Ishraghi, next to his father, Ishan Ishraghi. What was her fault? This is another boy, Mehdad Heri. This is an elderly woman. These are just few of the photos. There are many of them. And the question is, what is the fate of the world? What is the fate of countries and international organizations? Why have the international organizations lost their power, lost their sway? Why so many international laws can be violated and breached? We were acting on the basis of international laws. So why basically everybody who can violate them?
Here's what Israel would say. They would say that you, your country, not you obviously, Your Excellency, have been using proxies to attack them. And that you have for a long time been attacking them through those proxies. Your argument often I hear is, we don't use proxies, we help people defend themselves against Israel. So you say, we help different groups around the world defend themselves against Israel. They say, you entice those groups to attack them. Which is it?
The very term proxy groups is wrong. It's absolutely wrong, I think. Israel itself is a proxy of the United States in the collective West. So it's absolutely clear that the Israeli regime is basically a representative of the United States and the collective West in the Middle East. We had a revolution in 1979. After the revolution, we saw that many other nations come to us, asking us for help across the world, especially in the Islamic world, in the Arab world. Arab nations have come to us. When they saw us stand up against Israel, when they saw that for over 3 years Israel had been bombing the Gaza Strip with so many casualties, they wanted someone to protect them, to defend them. And Iran did just that. They managed to hit Israel hard. And once we managed to hit Israel hard, other countries came to us. We didn't come to them, they came to us. The Israeli have been aggressive against Iran in 1981. They came to Beirut, and the people of Lebanon created resistance movement. In 1981, when Israel attacked Lebanon, Iran was, had 2 years after the revolution. Iran didn't have any proxies back then. But the creation of Hezbollah in Lebanon, when Israeli forces came all the way to Beirut, the Lebanese themselves initiated a resistance movement against Israel. And that movement stood up against Israel. You know, when there is aggression going on, it creates aggression, it creates resistance. They had the Shabar territory.
What does
Israel, what they have been doing in Palestine? They basically forced Palestinians to take up arms. The small territory of the Gaza Strip has been blocked and sealed for decades. People there are cut off from their neighbors. It, basically, it's one big prison created and supported by the Israeli regime. People living in those in that prison, one day they will think about breaking free. Of course, they will resort to terrorism. The result of those groups' actions is the result of Israel's actions. It's all up to the Israelis. As long as they hold so many people in jails, torture them, Israel has built lots of prisons, and as long as they keep people there, it will continue. Of course, the resistance will persist. The Gaza Strip, over 70,000 people dead there. The people of Gaza, my question is, the people of Gaza, there are about 2 million of them, maybe 1.5 million. 1.5 million people saw the atrocities, saw the crimes. Those people, they have a future. The children who saw their fathers and mothers being assassinated, their brothers being killed, they saw their houses being leveled. They live without water, without medicine, and this has been boiling up for 20 years. What's going to happen to those kids? You either have to kill all those kids, or they will continue living, and they will act. See, you can't kill a father and expect to have tea with his son. This son is going to take up a Kalashnikov and fight against you because you killed their parents, because you destroyed their houses, because the Israelis don't feel that they, with their own hands, create resistance against themselves.
You have been so gracious, Mr. Ambassador, with your time, and I have felt like I'm having a conversation, a real conversation, a real exchange. There's nothing in this conversation where you have expected that I had to ask certain questions. You haven't put limitations on my questions. We've just been talking like friends, smartly, about important subjects. And that's journalism, that's freedom of speech, and I want to tell you how much I appreciate that, because there really are a lot of important issues that we've gone over, and I know I've taken a lot of your time. But let me ask you just one more question, because, you know, when we think of Iran, unfortunately, in many countries in the world, and especially the West, there are very negative connotations, very, very negative connotations about Iran. And yet, when anybody who has a book who they can read or can look at history, the Persian culture, the Persian people, are probably one of the most important cultures in the history of the world. So we have this dichotomy between this unbelievably important region of the world with a culture which is absolutely intelligent and magnificent in so many ways, and yet we have this picture that's being drawn for me as an American who grew up in America, and other people in places like Europe who think somehow Iran is evil, et cetera, et cetera. So that's what we have. We know that. You know that. So here's my question. Please tell this camera, our audience, which will likely reach hundreds of millions of people around the world, what is it about Iran that we need to know?
Yes, first, I'd like to say one thing on camera. You as a journalist know very well and realize that the media is basically an instrument used to create a wrong picture about Iran. They create a wrong impression about Iran. And who finances that media, who supports it, especially in the West? Why are they enemies with Iran? Why don't they want to show the true face of Iran? For 20 years, I was a member of the Iran's parliament, and I was a speaker in the Commission on National Security. And indeed, I had great ties with the Western media, with Western journalists. I gave lots of interviews. When they were asking their questions, in the end of any interview, I would ask journalists two questions. I would ask, have you visited Iran? They mostly said, no, that's my first time ever. And I would ask, what was the picture in your mind before the trip and what is it now? And there was not a single case when they would admit that they were thinking wrong about Iran. Because it's the mass media that creates the sentiment, that creates the picture. And unfortunately, this instrument is in the hands of the West, of the United States. The Iranian nation is a great nation. And the magnificence, the glory of Iran and its people is that amid aggression against us, you can see for yourself the Iranian people unanimously stood up and resisted. Of course, certain part of our society had differences and criticized the government. There were differences, there were problems. But when they saw Iran being threatened, when they saw Iran being attacked, they united and they stood up. They united against the ideology of Iran under the flag of Iran. Iran is a vast country. Iran is a country with amazing history. Well, I was a parliament deputy, and people from European countries, parliamentaries from European countries visited Iran, and they said they couldn't believe we were under sanctions for 40 years. And those were, well, fierce sanctions, but Iran is developing. Iranians built their country themselves. Iran is a big country. It's a beautiful country. And during the 12-day war, when people in Iranian cities were sitting in bomb shelters, Iran continued working. They were helping each other. They were. And dear viewers, I'd like to tell you this. You remember when there was the coronavirus epidemic across the world, in many countries of the world, people would storm supermarkets and retail stores, stealing masks from each other, and in Iran, people simply didn't go to stores just to leave commodities and goods for other people. They shopped less. And there were gas shortages in Iran, I mean, car fuel shortages in Iran, and people in Iran helped each other. There was a doctor in Iran who posted on his page that they expected huge lines to form in bread stores, but people chose to buy less bread just to make sure that everybody gets equal share of bread. This is what Iran people are like. This is what Iran is like, and nobody can break Iran and its people.
I sense your passion and your love for your country and for your people. Mr. Ambassador, I want to thank you for this interview and for giving us so much time. Thank you very much, sir. It's been a great interview.
I'm also very thankful to you. Thanks to you and your colleagues at Russia Today. You speak the language of truth, and you will convey truth to any viewer. I probably gave good answers because you gave me good questions. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. That's very kind of you to say that. I appreciate it.